And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. My profound apologies to anybody who tuned in on time today expecting to hear the show. The last show ran over. And my apologies to my guest, who will be on in just about 1 second. Anybody on my mailing list that is who receives my mailing list from faderfiles.com, my website, has to go straight to the website to keep up to date. The mailing list is down temporarily. So go to faderfiles.com, which has some new postings because my mailing list is down. Today we do have with us Sibelle Edmund. Sorry for starting late. You there?
No problem. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. She is the author of a new book called Classified Woman, the Sibelle Edmund's story. Now, let me give you a little background on Sibelle Edmunds, and then we'll get into our show. She's the editor of Boiling Frogs Post, boilingfrogs.com, that is, and founder director of the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. And just briefly, she's the recipient of the 2006 Penn Newman's own First Amendment Award, and has appeared on national radio and TV as a commentator on matters related to whistleblowers, national security, and excessive government secrecy. And she worked as a language specialist for the FBI, where she reported on serious acts of security breaches and cover-ups. This is shortly after 9/11. And for that, she was retaliated against and ultimately fired. And her journey after that is a lot of what this book is about, and that's something we're going to talk about right now. So where to start on this? Your background, maybe a little bit of your background, because it's in the book as well, because people, all kinds of things happen to people, don't react the same way, but you have a particular background that set up your personality and the way you would look at being treated in terms of being treated unfairly or repressively by a government. Maybe you could explain a little about, you know, where you come from, your childhood.
Sure. Originally, I'm from Turkey. My parents, they are Turkish, and in 1968, my father moved to Iran with my mother right after they got married, and I was born there. While he was working there, he was a doctor, he was a surgeon. He established the first burn center hospital there for reconstructive surgeries for the burn victims. And my father was also a political activist. He advocated for workers' rights, which were non-existent in Iran. This is during Shah's regime. This is long before the Islamic Revolution there. And for that, my father was interrogated. He was jailed. He was tortured. They pulled out his toenails. And the reason they cited was he was in possession of communist books. And well, one of those communist books was Steinbeck at the time. So he remained an activist even after those retaliations and incidents. Then we went back to Turkey after the revolution, and this was right after the military coup in 1981 in Turkey, and this was done through the United States of America and the Turkish military. So we had to deal with a lot of things like censorship, which still continues today, just as bad, and curfew, etc. It was basically, and it's still in a way, a military regime, even though we have this cosmetic elections there in Turkey. And but in high school, I was a writer. I was joining this competition between high schools, and I wrote about censorship and the consequences of censorship in Turkey. And my parents were called to school, and they were asked to have me withdraw my essay and not submit it to the competition because I would be jailed. And this was when I was 16. So I came to the United States when I was 18, as soon as I turned 18, and I went to university here. I got my degrees in the United States, and I mean, for me, this was an amazing place, and especially theoretically, because I mean, I was just so ecstatic to live in a country that had these things such as separation of powers. I mean, wow, and First Amendment, you know, that 99% of the world, they don't have First Amendment as their main law, which is our constitution here.
Right. And a court system, and you could dress.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
I was just—I mean, you were given to a right to an attorney, and did they actually assign you an attorney? Then those things didn't exist in Iran, Turkey. So I was one of those very, very happy because I became a citizen, and I was very happy. I said, "Well, I put all those days behind me, those climate, the environment, and the suffocation, and here I'm living in a place that everything is taken care of. It's such a great place, and all I have to do as a citizen is to just go and vote, you know, every 4 years, and make sure I don't break the law, you know, except maybe a few speeding tickets. Mm-hmm. So I was like the 97% of the majority in our nation today, and I thought that I was a good citizen because I didn't break the law, and I voted, and I paid my taxes regularly, and that's where I was until 9/11, okay. Until...
Before 9/11, you had submitted an application. You were studying public administration, and give me what your degree interests were.
Oh, sure. My bachelor's degrees were on criminal psychology and criminal justice, and I worked as an advocate for sexually abused children for the Alexandria Court, mm-hmm. as a volunteer, because I also worked with a family business that my husband and I had set up here. Mm-hmm. So in 1997, I submitted an application with the FBI for an internship position, mm-hmm. in their department that dealt with crime against children. I was never, ever interested in working as a language specialist. Yeah, I spoke those languages, but I considered translation being such a boring job, it's a desk job, and mm-hmm. it was not something I was interested in. When I submitted my application, the FBI contacted me, and they said, well, they didn't have any position, internship position for me at their in their department for the child crime against children, but they were extremely interested in my linguistic skills. Would I be willing to go and take proficiency exams and et cetera? And I first didn't want to do it, but then I said, well, maybe this would be an entry to where I really wanted to end up, which was in the criminal division. So I went and I took the test, and I didn't hear back from the FBI. They were supposed to conduct my background check, and years later I found out, this is 3 years later, that they had lost my application, which mm-hmm. included all my bank account information, all my family history, etc., together with 150 other language specialists who had applied with the FBI.
They lost all of that?
150 files, and we are talking about thick files here. All my medical history, all my tax, everything. So then 9/11 took place.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 days after 9/11, I received this phone call from the FBI's headquarters. And this gentleman said they badly needed my language skills because I didn't speak only one, but three of their most needed languages.
Which were what?
I speak Farsi, that's the language spoken in Iran. Mm-hmm. I speak Turkish, that's my primary language, that's where I'm from. And I also speak Azerbaijani. Azerbaijani is a dialect of Turkish. Mm-hmm. It's a Turkic language. And my father's family, they were from Azerbaijan.
So they call you in, and you start virtually immediately, right?
They asked me to show up the next day to get my clearance briefing and start immediately. They said, as a contract linguist, since you're not able to work full-time, you are too busy, mm-hmm. and you determine your hours, we are desperate for language specials. In fact, they were saying that on TV every day after mm-hmm. 9/11. You know, we need translators. We need language skills. Our nation is under attack. There are these terrorists who are going to attack us even further. I mean, this was... Even though I really didn't have the time, it was like, this is my opportunity to serve my country.
Right.
You know, 9/11 happened, and people were asking, what can I do? Well, here there was something I could do because the FBI was telling me I had something to do to help my nation.
So you could be patriotic. You could show your regard for America, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So then you start there, and this is sort of where the book takes off in a very sort of sorry and sad and exciting way all at once, right?
Right. And as soon as I started, in fact, within a few weeks, I started finding out about various problems, some of them, you know, incompetence related and bureaucratic, but then there were others that were major mm-hmm. issues that were being covered up. And I also want to make a quick distinction here, and that is this, when I'm talking about they were being covered up, not by agents. I mean, all the field agents I worked with the FBI, they were all great individuals. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were just like me. They were trying to do their best to do something. And when I say cover up, a major cover up, these were higher ups in the FBI headquarters that basically boiled down to the FBI's director and assistant director. And even outside the FBI, the real power, that was driving these major cover-ups, that was the State Department and the CIA. You know, you had on one hand an agency, FBI law enforcement, who were trying, and these are the agents, to chase terrorists, et cetera, and find out more about what happened with 9/11. On the other hand, you had the agencies such as the State Department and the CIA who were panicked, and they were very busy covering up and also preventing the FBI from conducting investigations because of the dealings they had, shady dealings they had with various financial and terrorist organizations for years and years and years.
So initially what you experienced, and you make it very clear in the book, which, by the way, is, to use a very hackneyed phrase, a page-turner. You know, you keep wanting to find out what happens next because it is almost like sort of some inside, you know, inside spy thriller. But the first thing you encounter, which is extraordinary when you read this, if you don't believe in this kind of thing and you don't understand it, is the amazing amount of incompetence and political maneuvering that's going on in this office, like it was like an insurance office or something. Drawers unlocked with files in them, files being taken home, classified information being taken home by people, that kind of thing, right? That's what you're first...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for example, they had these extraordinarily sensitive, loaded laptops that the agents were supposed to be taking these laptops during the court process into court outside the FBI. And ordinarily, under the rules, these laptops, I mean, you're looking about dozens of laptops, were supposed to be kept in the secured facility called SCIF. And people had to sign and be accompanied by an agent to remove them. Every week, we were getting emails saying three laptops had disappeared without being signed up because they were not being kept inside the SCIF. Please return it and establish chain of custody. Hmm. That was just one of hundreds of issues of incompetence that were happening on a daily basis inside the FBI.
Well, then there's the other thing, which is this could happen in any office, any place. And in fact, it could happen in any bureaucracy in any country. When you were assigned certain jobs, and then if you had to travel or something, you get travel, you know, you get an expense account, you could do this, you could do that. So you're working so hard, you want to serve your country, you're an efficient, intelligent woman, you do all this stuff, you get your job done early, you want to come home, you know, and you get told by your boss, you know, stick around, stay at the hotel, and then when you ask for an explanation because you don't understand what's going on, he says you're going to make everybody else look bad, and this is when you begin to see how things work in the office, right?
Absolutely. This was my first and hopefully the last job with the government. And for me, it was shocking. For a lot of people, I guess they had gotten desensitized because they didn't. When you're in that environment years after years after years, this becomes a norm. For me, it was outrageous because I was paying those precious tax dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to those, I had to, and I still do, have to pay for my own, you know, for private insurance for my family.
Right.
You know what? And yet, you know, this is what, we don't have healthcare system to provide people with decent healthcare at, you know, very low cost. And on the other hand, hundreds of millions of dollars, if you add other agencies such as Pentagon and CIA and all of those, Department of Homeland Security, billions of dollars. You add wars to these, trillions of dollars of taxpayer money being, you know, abused by waste, fraud, and in some cases criminal activities. They are unaccounted for. And here we are as citizens. We are scrambling as a nation, whether it is, you know, for all these economic issues, and then you have, of course, healthcare. I mean, our state of our education system. I mean, our libraries here, you know, where I live in Alexandria, they cut back to nothing the programs they had for children for the neighborhood because they said they don't have the, you know, budget.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you have trillions of dollars being wasted due to fraud and abuse, and as I said, in some cases, criminal activities. And again, there is no branch of government there to hold these people accountable, even though in theory, again, I have a master's degree in public policy.
Mm-hmm.
It is supposed to be this great Congress that looks at those budgets.
Well,
you
had your experience with Congress later. Since we have, unfortunately, a limited amount of time, we should... So when you're working there, this is after 9/11, there's two major things that you come across which are astounding to read about when you actually hear it from somebody who was there. There's two things that you stumble across. There are major Turkish... American cooperative sort of business, in some ways spy agencies that work against American interests or sort of like concentrating international criminal behavior, which hurt the United States. And they had very close connections with a lot of people. And you discovered this out. And some of that had to do with actual spies that you discovered in your own department and sort of a larger network of spies and influence. That's one thing that was shocking, which you can talk something about. The other thing was, of course, that you discover you were sent some tapes to translate by an agent who's interrogating somebody who he's got some leads on about 9/11, and you start to discover there's all kinds of information that hasn't been translated before or was translated wrong, and it revealed that, and then you discovered what a lot of people have come to know, that the FBI or some people in the FBI and other agencies, other Secret Service agencies and other governments, had told people at the highest levels, all the way up to the president, that something was going to happen in great detail, and this is what you stumble across, and then you get in the middle of this, right?
Absolutely. And even to date, after, 2002, the FBI, they did not provide this information to Congress. At the time, Congress had the Joint House and Senate Intelligence Inquiry into 9/11. This information was not provided to the 9/11 Commission, and they were buried. They were completely covered up. And as far as the other case with this Turkish lobby slash business organization, well, their network also had penetrated or had in their under their umbrella U.S. high-level U.S. officials, both elected in Congress, at least dozen of congressional people, representatives, and from both parties, and also within agencies such as the State Department. And, for example, the espionage case that penetrated the FBI, that was already confirmed. It had been confirmed. It has been confirmed by the Inspector General's office. This is for the Justice Department.
Yeah, but this is something you discovered, and you tried to go through channels, again, being, you know, sort of a decent citizen and respecting what you thought originally had been, you know, the integrity of the FBI. You went through channels all the way up, and this is mostly what the book is about. You go to your supervisor, you go to your supervisor's supervisor, you go to an agent in charge of an investigation.
All the way to the director.
Right. And then they keep covering it up. Now, why did they cover up this information? Although the answer may be rhetorical, you could tell us why.
Well, initially, it was the canned response you would get, any whistleblower would get internally when they blow through their report, is covering your own hide, basically.
Right.
And it is, we don't want to look bad. This is just a couple of years after Robert Hansen's spy scandals, and the management, they were in panic. They, oh my God, after Hansen's, we're going to have another huge scandal, and this is going to be disastrous for the FBI's image. Later, it got worse, the cover-up, because then it involved Pentagon and the State Department and the CIA. And those three agencies, they came and they pressured the Attorney General at the time. It was John Ashcroft and FBI's Director Mueller. They said, you need to invoke state secrets privilege in Sybil Edmonds' case. Now, I was not an informant or an undercover agent. This was unheard of. In fact, I was the first victim of George W. Bush administration when it comes to invocation of state secrets privilege. And because my case, as the first case, set precedence, they then started, this is they being the government, started invoking this privilege over and over again. But it was invoked by the Attorney General because the State Department and CIA, they said this is going to ruin all sorts of diplomatic relations for U.S. and a bunch of operations. These are black ops, and therefore you need to gag this woman.
And you're gagged for all sorts of reasons, for publicity and going public and everything else, but by this time you were already in the federal court system trying to press your case about how you were illegally fired and your rights to free speech were, and also you still wanted these facts, the details of these awful things you found out to be public, so you have to go to court. You're in the federal court system, and then they use this gag information, right? This gag rule.
Absolutely. I was in two places simultaneously. I was active because at this time the Congress was investigating my case. They were planning to hold hearings, and I was also in court, federal court, trying to bring this information and the truth and make it public and hold these people accountable. Not the people who fired me, people who've been engaged in this cover-up with serious consequences for Americans' national security, but also liberties. So I was fighting, and in both cases, they gagged the court case by classifying me. This is why the book is called Classified Woman. Mm-hmm. The ACLU represented me. They took my case all the way to the Supreme Court. And the government would say I couldn't even attend my own hearing. My attorneys and I, we had to leave the courtroom for the government to argue its case against, I mean, it was just, it was Kafkaesque.
Mm-hmm.
And with Congress, again, the government did something that was unprecedented, and if they haven't done that since, the only case, they actually issued a gag order on the entire Congress through retroactive classification, saying that all these Senate offices had to drop investigating my case. They had to pull off everything from their website that referred to me, and they were gagged from ever referring to my case and talk about my case.
Well,
now, this is illegal, unconstitutional, because mm-hmm. the executive branch can never issue gag order in Congress, yet the United States Congress abided by that. They pulled everything up, and you're talking about tens of thousands of people had downloaded those documents. That information was public for 2 years almost.
Mm-hmm.
They pulled them off, and they just zipped, and they said, we're not going to touch your case.
You know, I'm quoting from the book here. This, by the way, if you're listening to Sybelle Edmonds, E-D-M-O-N-D-S, Sybelle Edmonds, and the book is called Classified Woman, which I noticed that you published yourself, right?
Yes.
Did you submit this to publishers?
Yes. And this book, currently FBI still is saying I'm not allowed to publish a single word of this.
Still, even though it's out?
Yes. And they have been sending letters for the past 1 year to my attorneys. And I abided by the Constitution and also FBI's own laws, and this is Department of Justice. I submitted for pre-publication clearance.
Mm-hmm.
They had 30 days to redact it, give it back to me. Instead of doing that, the government said, you can't publish a single word. And my attorneys and I, we said, you know what? We have First Amendment. This is Constitution. And plus, we did what we were supposed to do. We submitted to you. You're not even giving us redacted version. You're saying you can't publish any of this book.
So I
challenged the government, but I also challenged the big corporate publishing houses.
Right, right.
Because they told me, and let's think about the top three, top four. I mean, they said, no question, this book is going to, you know, most likely be popular or sell.
Right.
However, we need guarantee from the FBI that we're not going to get into trouble by publishing this. I said, well, I submitted it, and I took care of my part of the deal in terms of 30 business days. They said no. And then another large publication house asked me to redact anything that I have written on Obama administration and their track record on whistleblowers.
Well, their track record is worse than Bush's.
As far as whistleblowers and
yeah.
First Amendment goes, unfortunately, yes, and I didn't think that could be possible. I mean, I didn't think it could get worse than George W. Bush.
Well,
and I started rewriting this book after the elections because thinking, okay, things were going to be different.
Mm.
And yet Obama, President Obama, is the only president in the United States that has jailed and prosecuted whistleblowers, not one or two, seven. Prosecuted seven government whistleblowers, truth tellers. I mean, this is not only Bradley Manning.
So,
there are several others. So they asked, they said, it has to, your case happened under George W. Bush. Why don't you leave? It was very, very direct. Why don't you leave Obama out of it?
Well, the publishers did.
The publishers did. And this is one particular publisher. And I said, well, because this book is the story of 10 years and 3 years of it is under President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the director of National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. And this book also deals with the issue of truth telling and government whistleblowers and the fact that the channels, there are no channels to go and report. I thought there were so-called channels. I went to Congress. I did all the right things before this case became public 10 years ago.
So, you know, we're unfortunately, since we started late, we can't really spend as much time because I do have another guest coming. But what I want to do is emphasize that everybody should really read this book. I mean, if you want to find out, I mean, if you didn't already, if you suspect that the government does not have your interests in mind, in fact, may actually be your own enemy, and that it's more of it's assuming the state of a monarchy or a dictatorship rather than a regular, what you were brought up perhaps or what you assumed was an American free society. It's not. And this is the kind of book where you get a very good example from the inside of somebody who went through all this, probably had a lot more willpower and bravery than you might. But finally you wind up forming this, the National Whistleblowers Association. And then maybe you can tell us about this website too.
Well, this is, even as this organization, which we formed together, and there are no board of directors, no bureaucracy, we didn't accept any funding from anyone. We just wanted to stand up for ourselves. I have 150 national security whistleblower members from CIA, Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security. Hmm. And even at this point in 2005, I was naive. I thought if we were to go and lobby the Congress, we could, you know, have them pass laws on whistleblowers and have protection in place. After 3 years, I mean, that channel came to an end, because the only channel that really has been left to us is the Court of Public Opinion, because mm-hmm. with only 1% of that 90% that was mentioned on this show just a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. doing and being active and doing their fulfilling their citizenry responsibilities, it will not take place. It takes far more than that. And I would like to quickly add one thing, mm-hmm. and that is, you know, our government has been putting this propaganda that there are terrorists who hate our freedom and they want to attack our freedom. Well, there's only one entity that is capable of attacking our liberties and our freedom. The terrorists cannot get rid of our Constitution. They cannot attack our freedom. They cannot attack our Constitution. That attack can only come from the government, and it has been coming. Mm-hmm. Because as you see in this book, when people read, First Amendment has become a conditional right, no longer an absolute.
Also, they've
with our Fourth and Fifth Amendment.
Somehow they've managed, and this happens with the Occupy and any kind of protest anywhere, with all the local ordinances and with all the state laws and all the federal laws that have been passed, especially under President Obama's administration. What you see is now, essentially, they have decided that protesting, that expressing your right to free speech, to be a dissident in any way, these are almost terrorist acts. You are a terrorist if you try to express your right under the First Amendment. So basically, we have to have people like you, and people should go to this website. It's called boilingfrogs.com. Is that correct?
BoilingFrogsPost.com.
Yes. BoilingFrogsPost.com. And there are, as you mentioned, a whole long list of reputable people from the inside who are whistleblowers, who know what's going on. And I recommend absolutely everybody to get this book. You're going to go, it's on Amazon, which apparently is as big as the government, or money trumps everything, right? So Amazon will sell this book to you. You can get it as an e-book too, right?
Correct. You can get it on Kindle or Nook, Barnes & Noble.
Okay. As soon as it arrives on your Kindle, though, of course, you'll be flagged by the NSA. But so what? You know what? We all are already all the time. So you have nothing to lose. It's called check it out on Amazon. It's called Classified Woman, the Sybelle Edmonds story. And it's something you're really going to want to read. And it's an exciting book to read. So next time when we have you on, perhaps on another station where I have more control over things, I can give you a longer interview. So we'll do that, right, in a couple
of
weeks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fader.
All right. Thank you, Sybelle. I appreciate it. We're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back. Okay, this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. I urge you to check out our Facebook page. Just Google Occupied Territory and Facebook, and you'll be able to get the replay of this show. Also, we have this show on our archives here on PRN.FM, and all kinds of other information. If you want to post comments on what you heard today, if you have videos, comments, reports from demonstrations or Occupy sites, please go to our Facebook page, Occupied Territory on Facebook, and post those. And speaking of all this kind of thing, just yesterday, the Bank of America was having its meeting at its national, with the location of its national headquarters, which is in Charlotte. And guess what? Charlotte is also the place on September 3rd coming up where the Democratic National Convention will be having its convention, and the Democratic Committee will be having its convention. And this is no mistake that the Democratic Party will be having its national convention in a place which is the home to Bank of America, and also many other banking institutions have powerful presence there. So because these two entities are really the same thing for right now, the Democratic Party, Republican Party, the banks, the corporations. So there was a demonstration yesterday, and it's a kind of a warm-up, which is what a lot of people are claiming, especially also from Occupy Charlotte, a warm-up for what could happen and what everybody hopes will happen on September 3rd when the Democrats come into town to hold their, crowning their monarch again for 4 years. So we have two people on the line here, I think both from Occupy Charlotte. Who do we have on? Luis Rodriguez, are you on?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you.
Okay, and I think we have somebody else here who is from...
Yeah, this is Michael Zhitkov with Occupy Charlotte.
Yes. Okay, so we've got two people out from Occupy Charlotte. So maybe, I'm not sure how we're going to do this, but maybe somebody could tell me exactly, or both of you could tell me, how did the demonstration go? What happened yesterday with Bank of America?
Yeah, can I jump in?
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
So, yeah, I'm Luis Rodriguez. I'm a firm supporter of Occupy Charlotte. My organization is called Action NC. We're community organizers here.
Okay.
And we've had a great time helping to organize the Bank of America shareholder protest.
So yesterday, what transpired?
Yeah, it was a really monumental day for the Occupy movement and the city of Charlotte in general. We had around 1,000 people show up. The 99% really united, came together against Bank of America, which, as you know, epitomizes the 1%. They continuously put profit before the interest of the planet and the people. And, we had 100 people inside the shareholder meeting itself. We took to the streets, and we let them know that their practices have just got to stop.
Well, so there are shareholders involved in this, too, because shareholders are the ones recently, thank God, who are protesting CEO pay in various places. And I think it's finally catching on that regular shareholders are beginning to understand this. They won't keep putting up with this. But so what happened? What was the reaction like from the city authorities and the police?
Well, as you may know, we actually had ordinances that were passed in January.
I do, yeah.
Essentially targeting protest movements. And they claimed that this was necessary for the DNC. What they didn't really tell us was that they were going to use these ordinances for every political event, period.
Mm-hmm.
And so they declared this an extraordinary event. And, such items as markers, bike helmets, backpacks, coolers were essentially prohibited, all mundane items. And, regardless, we still showed up there undeterred and let them know that, they might call this an extraordinary event. For us in Charlotte, we're trying to make this an ordinary event, and we're going to keep marching on the street.
So were there...
Go ahead. Another thing was when we started the march, the police were out in force. They had dozens of officers on bikes, on foot, on motorcycles, all over the place, and they were telling us, you can't, you have to march here, you can't have anything but signs, you can't carry anything, you can't have the streets, and the people just would not be denied. We marched out, we had our signs, we had our banners, we had our puppets,
mm-hmm.
we had a huge debt ball, a humongous ball that was being dragged by a few people wearing chains around them, dragging this huge ball marked debt behind them,
mm-hmm.
and we took the streets, and it's just an example of how this ordinance is, these ordinances are ridiculous, and they're just meant to, as a scare tactic, to keep people from asserting their rights.
Well, so are you telling me there was no repressive response?
Well, we went in, we overwhelmed, there were so many people that we needed the street.
Mm-hmm.
And the police kind of said, okay, well, obviously we have to back up, so that's what they did, and they cleared the lane for us. We waited there, all of us in the middle of the street, facing off with these cars coming in the opposite direction,
mm-hmm.
and it was a really interesting moment where we didn't know how the police would respond, and to their credit, they saw the right thing to do would be to move the traffic aside and let us let us march, and that's what they did.
Well, I'm glad to hear.
I do want to add.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to add that one of our concerns is we've only had two extraordinary events declared thus far, and those are declared by the city manager, who's an unelected official. And at the end of the day, our idea here was that this was going to be a testing grounds for the police as well as the protest movement. But to be honest, we were expecting the police to have a reserved reaction because, you know, perhaps they don't want to give us an opportunity to legally challenge them before the DNC.
Oh, I see.
So that's a concern for us, that when the DNC comes around, that we might get a different response.
Well, you probably will get a different response because you see what happened, for instance, at the Republican convention in New York City in 2004. I mean, and also the city of Charlotte has been given a lot of money by the Department of Homeland Security. The police
exactly
are more
right.
militarized. There's a law against camping, and they're going to really come down pretty hard then. But that's the price of democracy. That's the price of, let's skip the democracy part because I don't know what that means anymore. It's the price of freedom, right? So this is what's going to happen. So that is a move on their part that I see what's going on. It's like a chess move, right?
And one thing that
I
like
could
add to that
mention,
we wound up our march from the Bank of America shareholder meeting all the way to the Bank of America stadium, and it is no coincidence that President Barack Obama will be accepting the nomination for the Democratic Party in the Bank of America Stadium.
Bank of America Stadium? Bank of America
Stadium. Yeah, in Bank of America Stadium here in Charlotte. That's where he will be accepting. You know, that's the culmination of the DNC. Will all be happening not only in a town controlled to a large extent by Bank of America, and headquartered in Bank of America, but in Bank of America's own stadium. So the connections there cannot be overstated.
Well, no. I mean, and this is something I didn't know either. But, I mean, I know that, like, Verizon and other huge companies, you know, build these stadiums and the places where baseball teams and other teams play and where there are concerts. And the cities are always very beholden to these places. Like, we have Citi Field in New York City. You know,
sure.
And basically what happens is the banks put their name on it, but don't hardly, as typical, the city winds up paying, taxpayers wind up paying most of the bill for this and forgive them the taxes on this. So basically, it shows you where the Democratic Party is at. They are no different than the other ruling party, the Republican Party. They are one party because why choose if you're using rhetoric all the time, saying you're representing the hopes and the change for the regular American, why choose a place that is basically one of the most concentrated bank company towns in the United States? I mean, this shows you where the Democrats are at.
Absolutely.
Right?
And to speak to that point, I think, you know, Charlotte, in my opinion, is ground zero in 2012. Not only do we have the DNC, but we just had the Duke shareholders meeting, Bank of America shareholders meeting, and tomorrow ALEC is going to be here.
Really?
So a lot of things are coming down in Charlotte, and I think one of the reasons why these companies choose to be here is they think that this is a safe place where they can protest and nobody's going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're really trying to do, the struggle in Charlotte is really to draw attention to those these corporations and their actions and bring the people out and normalize protest culture in the area.
Now, when it comes to Occupy, too, you have to think about what some of the main goals and objects are of Occupy in the first place. And the main one being this outrageous, you know, French Revolution-style income inequality. And Bank of America is perhaps the main villain. I mean, they're the main backer of Mountaintop Coal Remover. Right. I mean, you could list.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, they're the leading financer of the coal industry in the entire United States, which is the leading contributing factor to global warming. They're leading the charge on foreclosing on our homes in the community and profiting from that. And at the end of the day, they were obviously part of the cause for this global recession. And whereas they got bailed out and received billions and billions of dollars, you know, we as citizens and everyone else got sold out, and these individuals have received record levels of executive compensation. They pay no income tax. In fact, this last year they received a rebate, and that's due to their clever use of, you know, offshore accounts, schemes and scams and loopholes.
The Bank of America got a rebate from the United States government, right?
That's exactly right.
You know, I must have missed mine, but they got one, huh?
That's right. I mean, one of the chances we had yesterday.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go check in the mailbox. I guess I didn't see mine. So, but they got, I mean, it's just beyond, obviously people have to take to the streets. I mean, and this is something else I wanted to ask you while you're on the line here. You know, people, especially of my generation, I'm older, right? People will be politically active by clicking on a petition or by doing something online. But in the end, it seems to me, and this is from experience from the 60s, I go that far back, it's there's no substitute for getting out in the street and confronting these people, right?
Absolutely not. You know, one of the things that I noticed was that a lot of the media coverage, you know, I was remarking to a friend of mine, the problem with the media is they're so busy looking for a particular story that they miss what's going on, what's actually happening, and they're never really present.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no substitute for being out there, for joining your fellow citizens, and for making your voice heard. I want to say one more thing before I need to get off the line.
Oh, sure.
But I'm sure that we can go on about Bank of America's transgressions for hours here, but there's one thing that I do want to highlight. Bank of America is a major funder to a group called CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America, and they run private prisons. And part of their job, or part of what they've taken on, is to increase the jail sentences and the severity of laws in our country to increase this prison population and to really pump money and to make a profit off the prison industrial complex, which I know is a whole different show, but
it is terrible
going on that Bank of America makes a portion of its profits from the suffering of not only those who are incarcerated, but pulling those people in many cases unjustly out of their communities, out of their homes, and we're also fighting that here in Charlotte.
Well,
I measure called Ban the Box.
So they've got the whole thing wrapped up. In other words, if you go down there and you protest, if you protest anywhere, right, if you protest your foreclosure, if you protest what's going on at the Bank of America, protest what the Democratic Party and the president are doing, then you can get locked up. Then they can make money off you.
Right. Yeah, they figured out clever ways to make profit in every aspect.
Well, it's
they are some clever fellas. Let me tell you.
Yeah, well, that's why sometimes that's why the only answer to that is people forget that there is a fourth branch of government, and it really they forget that the fourth branch of government are the people who live in this country. It's not
that's
the
right.
court,
exactly.
not the, yeah, it's not all this other stuff which is all bought and paid for already. The fourth branch of government is what you guys are doing and what other people are doing down there. And we had one of the premier broadcasters from West Virginia and somebody who's really in the forefront of protesting all this coal removal who lives in West Virginia, Bob Kincaid, on here a couple of weeks ago. And he was a guest here, and he put it the case pretty clearly. Also, his whole family lives there, and everybody in his family and everybody in West Virginia is sick from what the Bank of America finances down there. So, and yet, and you brought up one last thing. I want to keep you on forever because we got to get off here too. But one last thing that always is a sad fact of life here in this country now is the corporate ownership of the media. So, for instance, if I read the newspaper, which I did this morning, my local newspaper is the New York Times. If anybody reads their newspaper in this country, you tune into any major television station, you're not going to find any mention whatsoever of what you guys did yesterday. Not one word, right?
Yeah, we're trying. I mean, especially at the local level, again, trying to normalize this protest culture. But you're right about that. I mean, that's one of our biggest challenges. We can stage these wonderful protests and try to highlight these corrupt practices of Bank of America. But if it doesn't get out there, you know, other people don't know about it. And so we did actually get quite a good amount of coverage, especially for a Charlotte event.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. It is going to be. You know, there's always that expectation that it can be spun a certain way or excluded altogether.
Well, I think for all sorts of reasons, there is safety and there's power in numbers. So I'm hoping, which is why I'm going to ask, you know, somebody from your group and both of you to come on again, maybe once or twice before the convention comes, to talk about plans or ways to deal with things and how to get there and everything else, the details. Because the only thing that gives us any safety anymore is to turn out in overwhelming numbers and to look these people in the face and to stand
That's
around
right.
where they are. The rest of it is not going to count anymore because you see what's going on with the laws they're passing. They've got the internet in their hands too. Every
That's
time
right.
they want, you know.
A perfect example of that is when we came out yesterday in full force. We didn't have a permit to march in the street, but we took to the streets immediately. And we kept our ground in the streets. And you know, when we're all together and amassed, united. You know, they couldn't push us off into the sidewalk.
All right. Luis, tell me where you're from, what your organization is.
So my organization is Action NC, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Action NC, or online at actionnc.org.
Okay, actionnc.org and all those other ways of access you mentioned. And then there's Occupy Charlotte, right?
Yeah, it's Occupy Charlotte. You can find us at OccupyCLT.net. OccupyCLT.net, and we have a whole host of actions before the DNC. Again, Charlotte's the Wall Street of the South, and we want to let people know that. And like I said, tomorrow at 9 in the morning, we're going to be protesting against ALEC. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you'll hear about that, and, you know, on forward to the DNC.
All right. Thank you very much, and I really appreciate what you're doing. Democracy is, or freedom in this country, is lost forever without what you're doing. So thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Okay. And we'll talk to you again down the line. This is Mike Fader. The show here is Occupied Territory. We're on every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time here live. Sometimes we don't start on time, but we are here. And then also there are podcasts that he broadcasts. I do another show on Monday, which is kind of free-form preaching, sermonizing, personal experiences. And it's all the same stuff, though. It's all how to be free in this world, and free inside yourself and free in this country. There are podcasts of all these things. Just go to prn.fm, on which there are many, many other very good programs, too. This is now, I would say, and I don't like to exaggerate, and I'm not being paid to do this, that this is probably the leading liberal voice in the entire country, and we're reaching more people all the time. There are other places that are sort of standard or assumed to be liberal or leftist voices. They don't even compare with this place right now, the depth of people we have and the width of the kind of thing that we cover here. So also, I want to mention to everybody, if you are on my mailing list or you go to my website to join my mailing list, you will not be hearing from me for a while because my server has decided that if I send out more than 200 emails, and I have many, many hundreds more emails, members than that on my mailing list, if I send out more than 200 emails an hour, I'm a junk mailer. I'm a spammer. So they kind of shut me down temporarily, and I have to work around that. So make sure to check on my website. If you don't hear from me, and you won't be for a while if you're on my mailing list, go to faderfiles.com maybe every week because I put something new up. The newest thing I put up there is that I invented, you know, those ads on TV where they have a drug that cures everything, and then for the next 5 minutes they tell you how your liver's going to explode and your brain's going to fall out of your head. I made up a drug like that that cures everything, and I have that on my website. So, and there's other political commentary and everything. So that will be for, and next week we're going to have somebody on this show who is an expert on growing food and growing produce in urban settings, which is something we're all going to learn how to do because, you know, prices are going to go through the roof. We're going to have to grow our own food. It's coming down to that. Okay, Mike Fader here with Occupied Territory. Nice to talk to you, and we'll talk to you again next week.